We're going to speak with De La Pira, a longtime journalist and author of 25 books, including the newly published Secrets and Lies, Operation Iraqi Freedom and the Collapse of American Power in the Middle East, sequel to the Iraq in the Eye of the Storm, as other books including Essential Middle East, A Comprehensive Guide, Iraq and Iran After the Gulf War and Iran Under the Ayatollahs. He is based in London, writes regularly for the New York Times, The Observer, The Guardian, The Washington Post, and The Nation, as a frequent commentator on CNN and BBC, as well as on Takes on the World. Welcome, De La Pira, again to Takes on the World.
Yeah, thank you.
Iran and its nuclear ambitions have been very much in the news for weeks and likely to remain so. The U.S., Israel, and the U.K. seem determined to stop them and have not ruled out a military option. Germany and France seem insistent but less aggressive, and Russia and China look like they are playing for time. This appears to be the greatest international crisis since the Cold War. Am I right in this?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a grave crisis, and basically what you said, that if we're looking at, say, from the American point of view, from the Bush administration's point of view, there Bush has basically four options. And of course, unlike what happened in the case of Iraq, this time Bush is working with the Europeans, because, you know, in the case of Iraq, only Britain went along with Bush, and both France and Germany opposed what they were doing or what they actually did in Iraq. But in the case of Iran, they're coming together of the Europeans and the Americans, but that doesn't mean that they will be able to have their own way. But ultimately, even the European talks were affected or influenced by the American power, and so it comes down to what America can do, which is the four options. One is, of course, you know, military invasion of Iran, just like invading Iraq and bringing about regime change, putting in somebody like Ayman Chalabi types people in power, they are trying to and failing, but that's another story. The second option, of course, is to have, you know, what's called surgical strikes, you know, hit those facilities which are supposed to be alleged to be included in the Iranian nuclear program, plus, of course, large military complexes where the Iranians will make their, you know, conventional weapons and so on. That's the second option. And then the third option, of course, is, you know, to have the UN Security Council come around and impose economic sanctions on Iran, which will not be effective if they do not apply to the oil sales by, you know, oil purchases of Iranian oil by outside countries. And the fourth option is, you know, to come to some kind of a diplomatic solution. And as you can see, Jeff, you know, that the first option, as I said, there are not, Bush doesn't have enough soldiers, boots, to do this. In fact, I'm not the one to say that. You remember Clinton a week ago said the same thing. We don't have the troops to go and attack Iran, even if they got an okay from the Security Council, which is unlikely because Russia and China will never allow military invasion of Iran, just the way, of course, happened. Of course, they did not allow them because of Iraq as well. You know, Security Council did not give a resolution, but the Bush and Blair went ahead. So that option is out. The second option of military strikes is probably the most likely if Bush doesn't get his way. And of course, if Bush doesn't do it himself, he will give a nod and wink to the Israeli government to go and do it. You know, and Israel will never do it without actually consulting and getting America on board. And the political consequences of that will be quite horrendous. If we think, or if Americans think, if Europeans think that things are bad in Iraq, and what happened in Iraq? 5 million Sunni Arabs in Iraq have tied down 160,000 U.S. and coalition troops. Now, you know how many Shias are there in Iran? 90% of 72 million Iranians are Shia Muslim, Shiite Muslim. And that comes to something like 63 million Shiite Muslims in Iran. And if they go on a rampage, if the occupation of their country, or if their country is hit, you can see what kind of reaction there will be. And remember that, you know, Hezbollah in Lebanon is a Shia organization friendly with America. the Palestinian radical organization of Hamas and Islamic Jihad are friendly with Iran. And, of course, there are Shiite Arabs in Saudi Arabia, most of whom live in the oil-bearing eastern province of Saudi Arabia. They are Shias, 25% of the population in Kuwait. They are Shia Muslims. And, of course, in Pakistan, they are Shias, and in Afghanistan, they are Shia Muslims. Now, if they react to these bombings of the Iranian targets, then I think America will be in deep, deep, deep trouble. So ultimately, we come to the UN sanctions, Security Council sanctions. And again, there, you know, sanctions can be at different levels. You know, you can apply sanctions like saying that officials, Iranian officials, involved in any nuclear program at home, whether it's peaceful or military program, they will not be allowed to travel abroad. This kind of restriction has been put before on Iraq, it has been put before on Zimbabwe, and so that is possible, but that will not affect the Iranians. I mean, if they, some of them can't travel, officials, so what? You know, no big deal. You know, so the only options which will work will be if the Iranian oil embargo takes place. And there I don't have to tell you. Just please look up in the newspaper or look up into me. What happened yesterday? The oil price went up about $3 plus. It's now $66. And, you know, and so Iran is the fourth largest oil producer in the world after Saudi Arabia and Russia and the USA comes Iran. And Iran is the second largest oil exporter within OPEC after Saudi Arabia. Now, if the Iranian oil is withdrawn from the world, where the world needs every drop of oil, what do you think will happen to prices? It'll go to $100. You know, beyond $100. And who is going to affect? It's going to affect American economy, European economy, and so on. So I think that is the kind of, these are the kind of cards that the Iranians have. So they are not shaking and shivering if you say UN sanctions are coming. But whether they will come or not is, again, a very big question, because as you rightly pointed out, Russia and China are not going to have these sanctions because China has very large oil and natural gas contracts with Iran. Not only that, you see, there are up to 20 European oil companies from Italy, from France, from Britain, who are, as we speak, doing the development and production of oil and natural gas in Iran. So if there's an oil embargo and if there are trade sanctions, all those things will have to stop, you know. And of course, that is really going to mess up things so badly that I can't tell you how bad it will be.
Well, it's interesting. It, you know, in reading what you've written, listening to what you're saying, it doesn't really seem that there's anything that can be done to Iran that would not cause a catastrophe on some level or another. Certainly, the majority of the troops that are being trained by the United States in Iraq are Shia. And the likelihood, I would think, of those troops turning on the U.S. in Iraq is very great. And
yeah, absolutely. I see, just the question, you see, of course, in my assessment, I'm aware that you left out Iraq, but if I were to go, the impact of attacking Shiite Iran, either by America or by Israel, and of course the Iraqi situation will get much worse. As I said, so far things have not gone as bad or much worse than they are now in Iraq, because Shiites being 60% of the population, or at least, passive way, accepting the American occupation as a kind of a stopgap affair, that America will, of course, leave a certain point, and they are in charge because they're 60%, so through democratic means, etc., etc. But if they find their fellow Shia country next door in Iran being attacked, then, of course, all this will change. And we just look at the names. Who is the prime minister? Prime minister today in Iraq is a man called Dr. Ibrahim Jaffri. He is a physician, He spent 10 years in Iran during Iran-Iraq War, which went on from 1980 to 88. And then when that war finished, then he came to live in London. He practiced as a in a medical practitioner in London, and his party, Al-Dawa, functioned from Iran for 23 years. And then the other leader, who is actually the leader of the Shiite alliance called United Iraqi Alliance, Al-Hakim, his group, which is called the Supreme Council of Islamic Revolution in Iraq, you can't be more direct than the name itself, Islamic Revolution in Iraq, and Sikri, they were established in Tehran in November 1982. So, of course, they are very friendly with Iran, and if they find Iran is being attacked, then, of course, they will give great trouble to the Americans and American troops. And the other thing is, you see, that Iran itself has, Iran is next to Iraq, 750-mile long border. And given that 1 million Iraqis during the Iran-Iraq War settled down in Iran, and something like 30,000 Iranian prisoners of Iraqi prisoners of war refused to go back home. They settled down in Iran, they married there, and all of them, or most of them, returned to Iraq because they are Iraqi nationals. They are Arabs, they speak Arabic. And of course, many of them are very friendly with Iran, and I'm quite certain that many of them actually now working with Iranian agents, as Iraqis, Iranian agents in Iraq, and if America gets very uses military force against Iran, naturally all of these people will turn against American interests, not only in Iraq, but all over the region. So that, you know, any military any military action taken by Washington, D.C., is going to be extremely dangerous and will destabilize the situation much worse than what's happening in Iraq today.
And I would think anyone looking at the map of the Gulf would see that should there be an attack on Iran, the Iranians could really stop the shipping of all oil through the Gulf.
And no, that's right. I think the Iran-Iraq War said for the possibility. I think that you know, that what you see, you mentioned, you know, that's called Gulf of Hormuz, which is about 24 miles wide, you know, and that could be blocked. But I think this was possibility was very much in the cards. Iran-Iraq was 1980 and 88 when Reagan was the president and he said this international waterway, we will not allow that. I think the Iranians don't really have to do it. See, just the main point we have to really grasp is that because the economies of China and India have taken off, of course, I don't have to repeat the figures, everybody knows, China's economy is growing at 10%. A year, Indian economy is growing by 8% a year. Between these two countries, you have 40% of human race. Two out of five human beings on this planet are Indian or Chinese. Now, their economies have taken off. Last year, the oil consumption in China went up by 15%. You know, and if you have 15% compounding, you know, that means in 5 years, you're doubling the consumption of oil. There's so much demand for oil. Every single drop of oil is in great demand in the world economy, chiefly because these two giants of Asia, who between them have 2.5 billion people, 2.5 billion out of 6 billion in the world, and their economies have taken off. They need oil badly. Therefore, the oil demand is so tight that if you remove 1 barrel from the market, the price goes up. And if you remove 4 million barrels per day that Iran is producing, and most of it is exported, it's somehow 3 million barrels are exported, then, of course, the price will just go up. And again, I don't have to speculate. Look at yesterday's price. It went up by $3.30, you know, on $63. So it's close to $66 plus. So you see, that is exactly what happened, because I have a very interesting quote here in the Herald Tribune, which is from an unnamed European diplomat who said, "We don't know how to hurt Iran without hurting ourselves." And these are his words, these are not my words, you know. I mean, of course, he can't give his name because, you know, this is a very delicate thing to say because he's, you know, and so you see, and if tomorrow Iran were to stop its exports either voluntarily or through sanctions, then a lot of oil in Italy, in France, and in Germany comes from Iran. And who will replace that oil? Because there is no oil anywhere else. So I think that is precisely what is, slowing down the Europeans, about, of course, they're talking, but when it comes to the real move, I think they will probably go for some kind of what I would call symbolic sanctions if that goes to the Security Council, which is not sure. As you know, on February 2nd, there will be the meeting of the International Atomic Energy Agency Board, which has 35 members who are different from the Security Council members, and there they will discuss the whole issue, as to what to do. And it is not 100% that they will decide to refer Iran to the Security Council, because China and Russia still want to find some kind of a compromise, and what kind of compromise we can discuss later on. It's not simply given. See, the main problem has been that the Europeans, and especially Americans, have thought so far, if we say sanctions, then the Iranians will simply just shake and shiver and say, well, please, no sanctions, no, we do what we want. No, they forget that Iran had sanctions, and under the sanctions, they fought 8-year-long war with Iraq when Saddam Hussein attacked them in September 1980. So if a country fought an 8-year, the longest conventional war of the last century, which you mentioned in my book, it was the Iran and Iraq military conflict, and that war for end of 8 years, if Iran could conduct 8-year-long war, the longest conventional war of the last century with sanctions, so what do the people think, that they are going to, sort of get nervous? Already, Iranians, because oil prices have been high, they have saved a lot of money, they have set up something called Oil Stabilization Fund, and they have this money, and of course, if they see any signs of sanctions, they will move that money out of European investment banks, put them into the Chinese banks, to put them in Asian banks, and that way they already have their nest egg. Plus, at home, they have already been building up the stocks of food and medicine, and the spare parts for the machinery and so on, so that in case there are sanctions, they can live without them for at least 3 years. So I think that some of these things that the Europeans and Americans are talking about, they haven't done their sums properly. They haven't understood the psychology of how Iranians feel. And the other thing you have to remember is, this is a Bush, and in those days, Reagan and company made a mistake. They thought that, regime is very weak after the Islamic Revolution, and if Iraq attacks them, they will fall apart. That time, Jimmy Carter was in the president. But you see, Iranians are very nationalistic. Iran is one of the longest, has the longest history, along with Egypt and China and Iran. They have the longest recorded history in the world. So people have a very strong sense of being an Iranians. And if there are any threats, all Iranians, whether they are secular, whether they are westernized, whether they have relatives in America or relatives in London or in Paris, they will all, I can assure you, rally around the flag of patriotism and nationalism and will support whatever the government wants to do. And that's another thing that, these guys sitting in Pentagon, in their balloons, have to realize this is exactly what I was saying before the invasion of Iraq, that if you go in there, nobody is going to come around and welcome the American troops with sugar and candy and this nonsense that Mr. Chalabi was then peddling. And this is the same thing you'll find here, that if there's any threat to Iran by an outside force, then, of course, all the people, no matter what their political views are, whether they like the mullahs or hate the mullahs, they will all rally around, because they are ultimately Iranians, very proud of being Iranians.
Now, it's interesting that there's only one sector in American society that is lobbying heavily for the U.S. to make a push on Iran, and that's a pro-Israel lobby. The neocons, with a Project for New American Century, of course, put Iran in their sights as well as Iraq. And in February, they're revving up for a big campaign. One group called a coalition of 12 Jewish women's groups called One Voice for Israel plans to have 1 million Jewish women call the president on the 22nd of February. Now, I had speculated that Israel would be the one to do the attacking with Sharon in power. But with Sharon now in a kind of a vegetable state, Israel is a bit of a chaos. That I would think might limit their options. And you mentioned in your writings that an attack on Iran would be a domestic issue, much as the support of Israel and the United States is a domestic issue. What do you think the condition of Sharon has changed the Israeli option?
I think what's happened here is since Sharon went into a coma, and I don't think even if he survived that he won't be able to function, you know, because he'd become, quite honestly, without being unkind to him, a vegetable. So basically he's politically dead. Now what's happened is, that his successor, Mr. Olmert, he actually has already set up an ad hoc committee to pursue this option of hitting Iran, every so often they publicize what they're doing because they think they're trying to scare Iranians, and most of the time they give leaks to the London Sunday Times. Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, sort of leaks this stuff, basically saying that we know where these nuclear sites are, and even RME doesn't know, and we're doing these preparations, and they drug graphs and charts and so on and so forth. Quite honestly, I said to myself, who are you trying to scare? But never mind. See, that particular program is still on, and just before Sharon had a second attack, he just said that he went and visited the unit which is working on it, a military unit, and after he went into a coma, his successor has set up an ad hoc committee which includes three people, himself, because he's not a military man, and two, his Defense Minister Shaul Mofaz, and who, by the way, Shaul Mofaz is originally an Iranian Jew. So he speaks Persian, and so they would think he's some kind of expert. But the third one is the Chief of Staff, military Chief of Staff. So there's a three-person ad hoc committee which will decide if they are going to go in, do whatever they say. There are 10 sites they will hit, they know where they are. And of course, don't forget that it was publicized about 8-9 months ago that the Pentagon has sold the Israeli Defense Ministry 500 bunker-busting bombs. Okay, of course, this is publicized to scare Iranians. So in a way, one can say that they're equal. But you see, I don't honestly believe, or even if this were true, nobody would believe that Israel did this without getting a go-ahead from, Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld. Nobody believed that, even if this were true. So therefore, the consequences of that action will be felt by the American interests in the region, which are much wider than the Israeli interests. In terms of Israeli interests, of course, Hezbollah will probably, escalate the attacks on Israel, or the Palestinian groups might get it a bit more rough on Israel. That's another story. But in terms of the timing originally was that, the IAEA quarterly meeting, which they meet every 3 months, was originally on the 6th of March. And the Israeli election, as you know, is the 28th of March. And amongst the three leaders, of course, Amir is of the Labour Party. I think he's a sensible man. He is focusing very much on domestic issues and how, the working people are suffering under the present government. And then, of course, you have Likud leader now, properly elected, Netanyahu. He is a bungho guy. And he, when he was contesting, remember, of course, Sharon was a part of Likud. He was the leader of Likud. When he was contesting leadership and challenging Sharon, he was saying, Sharon has not been anything about Iran. Iran is the biggest threat, etc. And all the lobbies, of course, in U.S. are very much on Iran, against Iran, etc., etc. And so, therefore, the feeling was, at that time, I'm just saying about 6 to 8 weeks ago, before the IA meeting of 2nd February, or before the second stroke of Mr. Sharon, at that time it was thought some action might take place between March the 6th and March 28th, so that Sharon can establish that, I am pretty strong, I did this thing. In a way, remember what happened when Mr. Menachem Begin was the Prime Minister in June 81, he attacked the nuclear facility of Iraq. And that remains a kind of something to brag about, and this is what Mr. Netanyahu was saying. See, Big Chief, they ended this thing. You know, that was 25 years ago or 24 years ago, and we had a quiet. If what quiet doesn't matter. And now, of course, we should do the same thing to Iran. But I'm afraid what was the scene in 1980, 81 is the world has moved on. The world has moved on. The main thing here is that oil is so much in demand that, you know, the whole geopolitics of the world are changing because of oil. If you remember, 4 days ago, there was an op-ed, there was an editorial in the New York Times which pointed this figure out. And just take out a very quick summary. Mr. Chavez, President of Venezuela, I mean, he publicly almost abusing the U.S. President. He always calls him Mr. Danger. He calls Mr. Bush Mr. Danger. And you say to yourself, how is this guy going to get away? Well, see what he has done? I'm giving you the example of how powerful oil is. What he has done, that he has signed an agreement with the 14 countries of the Caribbean and Central America, and he has said to them that whatever the price of oil, you will get Venezuelan oil at $40. So today, if they buy oil from Venezuela, they will get oil $26 cheaper than the market price. So you see, when there was a summit in Argentina, remember there was a summit in November in Argentina?
Yes.
So who was the star of the summit of all American countries in OAS? Organization American States, 34 countries got together, and who was the one who was holding the fort and making, you know, headlines, and who was the guy who nobody was talking to him, even though he speaks Spanish? Mr. Bush. He was lonely, and Chavez was going on all the way. He held a public rally where he spoke for 2 hours attacking American imperialism, neoliberal policies. What gives him the power? It's a small country, Venezuela.
It's the oil.
And so, because he has oil, so he has 14 countries out of 34 countries eating out of his hand. And see, so that is exactly. Now, if you know, again, if you go back to the Europeans and Americans and sanctions, I said to myself quite simply, European Union is the largest trading partner of Iran. If they are so angry with Iran, why do they have to go through this whole thing about IAEA and Security Council, blah, blah, blah? Why doesn't the U.S. Union itself say, now, we are going to have trade embargo against Iran. Boom. We won't buy any oil. We won't sell them anything, blah, blah, blah. Okay, they can do it. They don't have to go through this whole nonsense of IAEA and trying to get Russia and China on board. They can do it themselves. But why aren't they not doing it? Because they want the oil. They want Iranian oil. That's why. See, that's the whole thing. Yeah, so, you know, I'm sorry that most people, even some of the diplomats, they haven't fully grasped how the oil has changed, really changing rapidly the whole, you know, the trust of international relations, international politics. So these people are, you know, still going on as if they live in an imperialist world in which they can have their own say because they have got bigger guns, because they have atom bombs, etc., etc. But I'm afraid they need oil. Now, if you don't have oil, what use are your tanks and war planes? You know, what can they do?
The Germans found that out in World War II when they couldn't get their planes off the ground. In your writings, you talk about an issue no one seems to be concerned about here, and understandably, because this is the United States, but the concern of Iranians for their own security being publicly before this whole problem with Iran's nuclear weaponry came up. Iran was an open target of the Project for New American Century for the neocons. They have U.S. troops in Afghanistan. They have U.S. troops in Iraq. They have Pakistan, which is an ally of the United States. They are, in a sense, surrounded militarily. But no one seems to think that Iran, and of course Israel, has a nuclear weapon that nobody talks about.
That's quite true. I think, you know, even if you look at northern Israel, which has got 200, you know, atom bombs, but the question is, America, the most powerful country in the world, has got, take a deep breath, 600 and 6,400 nuclear warheads. Okay, I mean, you know, why does America need to claim 400 nuclear warheads? You know, who will attack? Anyway, so I think basically what it is, you know, as Iran is concerned, you know, as you rightly pointed out, that, you know, if they are going for the nuclear weapon, which the IAEA says we don't have evidence that they have an ongoing nuclear weapons program. That's their words, nothing to do with what I have to say. And you see that the Iranians, if they want to acquire it, I mean, they only look at North Korea. Why isn't Bush sending troops to North Korea to overthrow the regime of a dictator who not only has, according to CIA, 2 to 5 atom bombs, plus North Korea has the best missile system in the world after America and Russia, and the policies of Kim Jong-il resulted in the death of 2 million people in the 1980s because of the famine. So why isn't Mr. Bush, you know, attacking you in North Korea? Because they have an atom bomb. You know, I mean, at least the CIA thinks they have it, you see. So that means that if you have an atom bomb, then you cannot be attacked. So the Mullahs, if they're going to follow this thing, they can say, okay, if we want to acquire it, not because we want to use it against somebody, but, you know, this is a guarantee that we will not be overthrown just the way Saddam Hussein was overthrown by Bush and Blair. So, see, that would be their rationale. But remember one other thing, which, again, is quite missed amazingly. When the Iranian president at the Security Council in September gave a speech in which he said that Iran is prepared to invite or have foreign companies, private or public sector companies, to participate in any nuclear program that we do in Iran. We can have joint ventures with a foreign company, so they know exactly what we are doing, and if we are going to enrich uranium to 98% or whatever, they can actually stop it, and because they are joint venture. Nobody has paid attention to that idea. Iran has said that we want to talk to the IAEA, but we don't want to limit the IAEA delegation to 3 Europeans, because it's a 35 members, you know, where it doesn't only consider Europe and America, it has many other Asian, African countries, that we should have a bigger committee of the IAEA, which should include Russia, which should include South Africa. Remember, South Africa gave up its nuclear bombs in 1993. So they want to South Africa and Malaysia, which is the leader of the non-aligned movement, which has got 116 members of the UN as belonging to that group, not non-aligned movement, they say they want, we should have 6 countries delegation with which we are prepared to talk. But some Europeans don't pay attention to that. They simply say, no, we will talk to us. Therefore, I go back to the logic that if you don't like what they're doing, why doesn't the European Union itself have, you know, trade sanctions against Iran and forget about Security Council and so on and so forth. But you see, the whole thing that if Iranians are doing this, again, if you go through, in fact, you mentioned my other books, the book very pertinent to the subject we are discussing is called Iranian Labyrinth. And in that book, I explained that the whole idea of the nuclear thing came up because of the Iran-Iraq War. During the Iran-Iraq War, twice Saddam Hussein launched what is called the War of the Cities. He was able to extend the Soviet scuds, and extended the range of the Soviet scuds, doubled it, so that Iraqis were able to fire their reinforced the Scud missiles at Tehran, to the point that 1/3 of the Tehran's population of 6 million people fled from the city. They were afraid that any time these missiles will have chemical weapons which will hit them sitting in the capital of Iran. In 1987 this happened. It's at that point that Khomeini, who was the leader of Iran then, he died in 1989, he reversed his previous stand where he said atomic weapons are un-Islamic. But because when he found himself attacked by Saddam Hussein's Iraq, which was helped by the USA and the Soviet Union, I don't have to go through that, and there he reversed his whole position, because ultimately, just this one simple thing we have to understand, no matter where you live, what country, what system, what is the first job of any government? What's the job description of any government? Number one, any government in the world must protect, defend the territory, the country it is governing. And therefore, to have a defense, therefore to have weapons which are giving that particular security should be the top priority of any country. Doesn't matter whether you're Islamic, secular, Christian, Buddhist, or capitalist, or communist, doesn't matter. That's the first job. So that's where Khomeini reverses his previous stand to say, okay, look around and for the atomic things. And that is, see, if you go back to the whole thing, it was in 1987, late 87, that the Iranians got in touch with that Pakistani, atom bomb, what they call father of atom bomb, Dr. Khan. That's the whole thing started. So you see, ultimately it comes down to Iran, the rulers of Iran want security, that they will not, what happened to Saddam Hussein next year will not happen to them. So if tomorrow the USA, Bush administration, is really serious, they have to say up front, say, okay, we give you guarantee that we are not going to attack you in any circumstances, and let's sit down and talk. Then there's the business to be talked about. You see, ultimately, that's what comes down to. You know, because these mullahs, they are not simply, and they are not being, you know, they are not being theocratic and therefore nutcase or something. Every regime, does anybody tells me that the most corrupt, venal regime in the world, Saudi royal family, don't they have the same objective to keep themselves in power?
And I want to thank you very much again for this very, very informative interview. I really appreciate it. I know our listeners have as well. If they people have to find out all your books, is there a website they can go to?
My books are published on Nation Books.
Okay.
Amazon.com.
Very good. Well, thank you so much again, Dilip Hero, for being our guest today on Takes on the World.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.